It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
At this point, we hope that Congress does not cut the program's funding, because funding is certainly needed by the families who participated. Congress has not increased its funding for the program since enacting it back in 1996.
Public benefits attorney LaTanya Reed at the Virginia Poverty Law Center discusses the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, program and the reauthorization, which is due by September 30, 2011. And during this week's question and answer session, we explain a homestead deed and how it protects property you otherwise might lose to a creditor. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 135, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. The U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, began work on July 21, 2011, and the Bureau has plenty to do and plenty of power to do it, even without a director in place. Here are 10 items that the CFPB can start right now using existing authority. 1. Stop mortgage companies from charging illegal fees, keeping sloppy records of what people owe, forcing homeowners into overpriced insurance, or rushing to foreclose before considering home-saving options. 2. Stop banks from tricking people into incurring overdraft fees, help consumers get the cheapest overdraft coverage, and provide clear information on bank fees. 3. Stop 400% internet and bank account advance payday loans from grabbing consumers' wages, Social Security, or unemployment compensation before families pay food or rent. 4. Protect prepaid debit cards, a growing but unregulated bank account substitute, from identity theft, bank errors, and hidden fees. 5. Get inside the books of credit card companies to make sure they are not charging illegal fees or rate increases, and help consumers shop for the best card without back-end tricks and traps. 6. Force the credit bureaus to clean up error-plagued credit reports and to respond to consumers trying to fix mistakes. 7. Help students avoid expensive student loans when cheaper aid or loans are available. 8. Prohibit kickbacks to auto dealers who put consumers, especially minorities, into more expensive loans, and stop bait-and-switch tactics. 9. Go after debt collectors who make illegal threats, harass people for debts they do not owe, and pursue zombie debt long after it expires. And 10. Ensure that consumers who are transferring money across the country or across the world know exactly what the transfer will cost and how much their family will receive. Authority for all of these actions already exists under the Truth in Lending Act, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, Electronic Funds Transfer Act, Truth in Savings Act, Fair Credit Reporting Act, Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. For a longer list of action items for the CFPB, see an agenda for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Challenges for a New Era in Consumer Protection from the National Consumer Law Center at www.nclc.org. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Mullins versus Richlands National Bank. The bank sued three defendants named Mullins for judgments on three promissory notes. After the defendants admitted liability, the Tazewell County Circuit Court awarded attorney's fees of 10% of the principal amount owed, as set forth in the promissory notes. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Virginia reversed. The court observed that although the bank was entitled to attorney fees, a fact finder had to determine what fees were reasonable and had to consider the time consumed, the effort expended, the nature of the services, and other circumstances. In the Mullins case, the circuit court simply fixed a fee based on 10% of the amount owed, a fee which had no relation to the attorney's time and effort or to the nature of his services. Because nothing in the record supports the fee, it was not reasonable. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Mullins v. Richlands National Bank is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. Once again, it's time for the weekly question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Nikki. I'm from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Nikki. What question do we have this week?
My question today is, what is a homestead deed?
Well, Nikki, that's an excellent question. We get asked that a lot. A homestead deed is simply a listing of property that otherwise you could lose to your creditors, that you file that list of property with your local circuit court clerk's office, and the simple act of filing the homestead deed protects that property from your creditors. Now, most of the property that people have actually is already automatically protected from your creditors. For example, government benefits, whether it's Social Security, SSI, TANF, unemployment compensation, workers' compensation, it's protected. Pensions, retirements are protected. Child support is protected. And those monies, if deposited in a bank account, are also protected. Your wages, as long as they are less than $290 per week after taxes are withheld, are protected, and that protection also extends to those wages deposited in a bank. Up to $5,000 worth of household goods is protected, $1,000 worth of clothing protected, $3,000 worth of a firearm protected, and $6,000 worth of equity in a motor vehicle, again, protected. So most of what you earn, most of what you receive in income, most of what you own is protected. But there are certain forms of income and certain property that is not protected. Typically, that would be wages that you earn that are more than $290 per week after taxes. If you've got a creditor who's got a judgment against you, they can garnish those wages. And those wages will be forever lost to you unless you file a homestead deed before the garnishment period ends. It's a simple process, but you do need a lawyer to properly prepare the homestead deed, which you file with your local circuit court clerk's office, and then you go down to the court that issued the garnishment, you file your garnishment exemption, and then you finally go to court for a hearing and you claim your exemption. So the homestead deed, just as I say, allows you to protect property that you otherwise would lose to your creditors. Now, it's not an unlimited exemption. You get a $5,000 lifetime exemption for things that you want to protect from your creditors. If you are 65 years of age or older, the exemption is $10,000. If you are caring for a dependent, typically a dependent child, you get an extra $500 for each dependent. And then finally, if you are a disabled veteran, you get an extra $10,000 for a homestead exemption. But again, that's for your entire lifetime, whether that's $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000. So you need to use the homestead exemption very carefully. And typically, it's used in combination with a bankruptcy so that you protect stuff that you otherwise would lose to your creditors right before you file bankruptcy, or perhaps stuff that you would lose to your creditors even though you are filing bankruptcy. But then you protect it, then you file the bankruptcy, and then you've wiped out those debts, you get a fresh start, and hopefully you're not going to fall into debt again, and hopefully you're not going to need to use that homestead deed for many, many years thereafter. Was this an explanation that was helpful to you?
Absolutely. That was very informative because my perception of what a homestead deed was totally different from that. So thank you very much for that information.
Well, you're welcome. And in one clarification that I want to add, even though they call it a homestead deed, you don't need to be a homeowner. You can be a renter and you can still claim a homestead deed. And I think that's the source of a lot of confusion. Again, thanks for being on the show. We're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center in downtown Richmond, and we are speaking with LaTanya Reed, who is the public benefits attorney, and we will be speaking about a program that has faded a little bit from public view, but is going to be coming back into view in the next month and a half, and that would be the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, program. Welcome to the show, LaTanya.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Now, would you tell our listeners what exactly is TANF?
Temporary Assistance for Needy Families is a program that's designed to help low-income families with children. To qualify for this program, generally speaking, your family must meet these rules. First, your family must include a child who is a U.S. citizen or eligible immigrant and at least one adult relative of the child. A child must be under age 18, or if the child is 18, he or she must graduate from high school before age 19. In addition, as I indicated earlier, your family must be needy, and your family must meet good conduct requirements.
Now, you mentioned earlier that a family has to be needy. What do we mean by needy? Just how needy do they have to be?
Well, your family must have income after certain deductions below the maximum TANF payment for families of the same size in the locality where your family lives. There are no limits on the value of the resources your family can own in order to still get TANF.
Give us an idea as to the maximum TANF payment for families of a certain size so folks will know just exactly how high or how low the income limit has to be.
For a household of three people, if you live in a rural area, typically your income cannot exceed $546 per month.
And that's for a family of three?
That's for a family of three.
And what about an urban area?
For an urban area, typically speaking, a family of three cannot have income exceeding $726.
So that is substantially below the poverty limit.
That's exactly right.
Now, you also mentioned that the family has to meet certain good conduct requirements, and I understand that among those is a family has to cooperate in obtaining child support. What does that exactly mean? What does the family have to do?
In general, mothers must identify a child's father or the man who may be a child's father. They're not required to locate them, just simply identify them. Mothers required to identify a child's father must provide his first and last name and any three of 16 items, such as the father's race, occupation, schools attended, make and model of the father's car, or places of social contact between the child's mother and father. The information provided need not be current.
Now, I understand there may be exceptions to the identification requirement. What would those be?
Right. If an applicant for TANF does not know the identity of a child's father, her family still may be eligible for TANF in the following cases. First, if the applicant is not the child's mother. Second, if the child was born before May 1st, 1996. Third, if the child was conceived due to rape or incest. And fourth, if the applicant cannot provide the information because of mental incapacity.
Now, are there exceptions to the requirement that the applicant cooperate in obtaining the child support?
If you believe you or your child will be harmed physically or emotionally, if the Division of Child Support Enforcement tries to establish paternity or to collect child support, you do have the right to claim good cause for not cooperating. You may make your claim on a notice of cooperation and good cause, and if you make the claim, the Division of Child Support Enforcement must stop the paternity or child support case until your claim is decided. If your claim is rejected, you must be allowed to close your TANF case rather than allowing the Division of Child Support Enforcement to pursue paternity or child support.
Now, one of the reasons we're having this conversation now is that we're very rapidly coming up on the 15th year of welfare reform, which started in 1996. And one of the big issues there was capping family size for TANF. They imposed a family cap. Could you explain what the family cap of a capped child is?
In general, a child born while the mother was receiving TANF is not eligible for TANF unless one of these things is true. The child's mother was a minor at the time of the birth, the child was conceived due to rape or incest, or the child lives with a relative other than his or her parent. The disqualification from TANF while living with a parent lasts until the child reaches age 18. Children subject to the family cap can receive TANF while living with another relative.
In addition to the family cap, the welfare reform, I use that word loosely, from 15 years ago imposed certain work requirements on people who want to receive TANF. Could you explain those work requirements?
Sure. Some individuals who receive TANF are required to participate in Virginia's Initiative for Employment, Not Welfare. That is a program that is kind of built alongside TANF. And you must participate in VIEW, that's what the program is known as for short, unless you meet one of these exceptions. You are under the age of 18 or are 60 years of age or older. You are between 18 and 19 and enrolled in school full-time. You are disabled. You are the sole caregiver of a disabled household member. You are the parent or primary caregiver of a child under 18 months. You are a pregnant female in the 4th through 9th month of pregnancy. Or you are a caretaker or relative who is not the natural or adoptive parent. If you participate in VIEW, you must sign an agreement of personal responsibility saying you will participate in work activities. And if you are unable to get employment within the allotted time, you will be placed in community work experience. If you fail to comply with the work activity, you may be sanctioned.
So if the Department of Social Services proposes a sanction, is there some sort of defense that could be raised to that?
Yes, if you have good cause for not complying with a VIEW program requirement, you will not be sanctioned, as this was due to something outside of your control.
What type of things would that be?
It would include things like family or personal illness, lack of transportation, lack of child care, personal emergency, domestic violence, or unsafe, unhealthy, or dangerous working conditions.
So you mentioned things like lack of transportation or lack of child care. Are those types of things included in supportive services that have to be provided to folks who are in the VIEW program?
They are. Needed child care, transportation, and vocational training such as computers, GED classes, and driver's education must be provided. If child care or transportation is needed but not available, you can't be required to participate in VIEW or to keep employment. A VIEW participant must be put on an active status if DSS determines transportation is unavailable or DSS can't arrange needed child care. Any month that a person is on an active status does not count toward that person's 24-month time period.
And I'd like to follow up on the 24-month time period, because that was the other big issue from welfare reform 15 years ago, in addition to the family cap and the work requirement. That is the 24-month time limit to be on TANF. I understand that in general, people who are on TANF have a 24-month time limit, but there are exceptions to that. Could you tell us what those exceptions are?
The 24-month time limit does not apply to TANF families that do not include a child's parent or do not have to participate in VIEW, which is the program that we just discussed. A child who leaves his or her parent's TANF assistance unit before the parent's last month of TANF eligibility can get TANF while living with another relative. And there are hardship exceptions to the 24-month time limit.
And what would those hardship exceptions be?
Well, to get a hardship exception, you must submit an application for a hardship exception during the 60 days before the end of the 24-month time period. You may get a one-time 12-month extension if you are in school or training. You may get a renewable 90-day extension if you can't find work. You may get a renewable 12-month extension if you live in an area of high unemployment. And you must submit an application for an additional extension during the 60 days before the end of the extension period.
Well, you know, it seems like this program, maybe intentionally or unintentionally, was almost designed to force dependent children away from their parents. I mean, that's certainly true of a capped child who can get benefits if living with a non-parent, but can't get benefits living with a parent. And that's also true for a child who leaves the family, the natural parent, before the 24-month period is hit.
That is indeed. It is very, very difficult in certain circumstances for some of the kids involved.
Now, as we mentioned at the top of the show, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Program, or TANF, expires September 30th of 2011. We're 15 years into this experiment with, quote, welfare reform. What does the future hold for this program and its renewal in the next month and a half?
The truth of the matter is, Marty, at this point, things are quite unclear. So much of the activity in Congress for the last few weeks, as most people know, has been focused on deficit reduction, dealing with the debt ceiling. And so over the next few weeks, our congressmen and women are going to have to turn their attention to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And at this point, we hope that Congress does not cut the program's funding, because funding is certainly needed by the families who participated. Congress has not increased its funding for the program since enacting it back in 1996. So we're really playing wait and see to a large extent at this point, but the Virginia Poverty Law Center will be watching very closely as Congress does its work.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with LaTanya Reed. She is an attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, and we have been talking about TANF, or the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, and its looming expiration and hopeful extension after September 30th of 2011. Thank you so much for being on the show, LaTanya.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 22.1, which deals with education. Under Code of Virginia, Section 22.1-4.2, enacted in the year 2000, schools administrating tests or other assessment instruments shall not require any public elementary school students being tested to disclose their race or ethnicity on such tests. However, the statute goes on to state that nothing in this section shall prevent schools from obtaining such information from the student's permanent record and placing this information on such test or assessment instrument. This sounds an awful lot like the Commonwealth of Virginia's policy of don't ask, but we'll tell. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Money judgments don't collect themselves and are collected only by following strict legal procedures. Join us next week when private attorney Mike Bellotto talks about the collections process in Virginia and explains the rights of creditors as well as the protections for debtors. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.